You may begin.
May it please the court. My name is Scott Thompson. I'm here on Brian Dickerson's behalf to argue for an evidentiary hearing in this 2915 proceeding. Let me briefly preface my argument with some remarks about the facts that I think are pertinent to all three of the claims that we've made in this case. Mr. Dickerson, as you recall, was charged with second-degree murder in what I think could best be described as a bar fight. The state witnesses told the jury that Brian set upon a couple of bar patrons, picking a fight with those patrons in a bar where he was not a regular. Brian testified otherwise, that indeed the bar patrons started hassling him. He wanted to mind his own business, and a melee ensued, and he struck out, blindly hitting the deceased, a man named Frederick Buddy Jones. So the errors that affected the trial and appeal of this matter, errors that I'm here to demonstrate warrant an evidentiary hearing, all have to do with fundamental questions of intent and the presumption of innocence. Unless the court prefers otherwise, I'll address the points I raised in the order I raised them. Our initial complaint had to do with Dr. Dedeker's testimony that Mr. Jones's death was a homicide.
Could you address the shackling issue first?
I would like to, Judge. Trial counsel Brian was indeed prejudiced, really, in the eyes of the jury from the minute he walked into the courtroom. He was shackled throughout the proceeding. He pled as much in his amended motion that he had steel anklet on throughout the proceeding, and that at one point he was walked past the jury, not only in the anklet, not only with his anklet on, but also handcuffs.
There was affirmative evidence that the jury in fact saw him?
Well, there was no affirmative evidence, and indeed that's the very nature of our complaint in this case, that trial counsel was astutely aware of the prejudice that this would cause their client. They moved in limine to prohibit shackling in this case because Brian didn't warrant shackling. He had no history of violent offenses, no history of misconduct or disruptive courtroom behavior. And indeed, the state's theory of the case was that he was sort of a hothead, so they wanted to remove this prejudicial aspect.
But there was never on the record that there was there was no hearing as far as how dangerous he was with respect to the shackling. Let me back up, though. Refresh my recollection on deck. Was there any testimony from the jury saying that they saw the shackling and they felt it influenced them? Was there any jury testimony there?
No, Judge, and indeed this case was denied without an evidentiary hearing.
No, I mean the deck case.
There's nothing in the trial.
No, in the deck case. Get back to the deck case. Was there any jury testimony or affidavit saying they were influenced by the shackling in their determination?
In the deck case, Judge? Right. I do not recall, Judge.
In fact, Deck says that you presume prejudice if the jury saw the shackling. It says, thus where a court without adequate justification orders the defendant to wear shackles that will be seen by the jury, the defendant need not demonstrate actual prejudice to make out a due process violation. The state must prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the shackling error complained of did not contribute to the verdict.
But do we have to prove that he saw it? Do we have to prove that the jury saw it? That would be a... You have to prove the jury actually saw it. If they didn't see it,
right, Judge? And I think that's what this post-conviction proceeding really turns on, is the, how is this sufficiently pled? The respondent would say that even though we've stated numerous times in the amended motion that movement believes the jury could see this, he was paraded past the jurors in anklets and handcuffs. That nevertheless, the respondent would say, well, we have to plead that the jury actually saw.
And he pled that he went into the courtroom in anklets and handcuffs in front of the jury.
We did plead that, yes, Judge.
So you're saying there should be an evidentiary hearing in the trial court, the motion court?
Precisely. I think if the anklets perhaps were not visible, the motion court, which was the trial court here, wasn't the best position to say that that was the case, but they the motion court was rather coy on this issue, saying, well, there's no real record that he was shackled throughout the proceedings. And that's precisely our claim. Counsel needed to make this record, say to the judge, look, the jurors can see that he's shackled. You know, the space under the table, the anklets are visible. If we have an evidentiary hearing, maybe trial counsel could say, I didn't believe they were visible. I didn't renew my objection.
Did your client need to have pled that the shackles were visible to his counsel as well?
Well, of course, that's what the...
Or is that just obvious? If he's sitting next to his client, that he should know.
And that's our argument in response
sure begs
to the
fact
state's...
Question.
In response to the state's brief in this court, that, you know, we haven't shown that they were visible to counsel. But, indeed, he was assisted by two trial attorneys who were sitting next to him throughout the proceedings.
And he filed a motion in limine to preclude shackling.
They did, indeed. I mean, they would have had to have been the most inattentive trial counsel ever not to notice that their client was not shackled.
So it's not necessary to have pled that?
In retrospect, I guess now I wish I had, but I don't think that's... I mean, take the hypothetical of if he was tried in an orange jumpsuit that had the word jail stenciled back on his back. I mean, I think I'm making the same sort of argument here that it was obvious to counsel that his client was shackled. If movement can prove at an evidentiary hearing that the jury saw it, that he believes it was visible to the jury, surely it had to have been visible to trial counsel.
But at least you're saying you raise a fact question on that issue by saying he walked in shackles and sat next to his
Indeed
attorney.
Indeed I have, Judge. And I think that the rule in this court prefers an evidentiary hearing when there are these fact questions. And as I said, as the court pointed out, as you pointed out, Chief Justice, there is no sort of requirement that we should demonstrate prejudice, but I think it was nevertheless particularly prejudicial in the circumstance of this case.
And why was that?
Because, again, the state's theory of the case was that Brian Dickerson is a man who is given to violence, will attack people without provocation, that he's a hothead. If he's shackled in the courtroom, that sends a clear message to the jury that he's so disruptive and so unpredictable and so violent that he cannot even be trusted in a court of law.
But the court has to make a fine. After the given that the jury would see shackling, you could shackle someone who was a danger to the or do something to restrain him, a danger to the court personnel. But the judge would have to have a hearing on that and make that finding.
Yes, Judge. I think the trial court should have, and that's the fault that I lay at trial counsel's feet for not demanding that hearing, even though in the sort of hurly-burly of the trial atmosphere, probably they had 1,000 things they were getting ready for, they nevertheless had to make this record and get the court to not only make the record that their client was shackled, but that the prejudice that would ensue.
So did the Court of Appeals, in its opinion, then err in saying that it was the burden on defendant to show that the jurors saw the shackles and to show they were unnecessary, and as opposed to saying it was the does DEC require that the state show shackles are necessary in order to put them in?
I agree with the court's general proposition that that you've got to show that they were visible
right.
and unnecessary as a matter of post-conviction practice. Nevertheless, we've made that showing here. And I think whatever further proof the court might require is the proper subject of an evidentiary hearing in this case to show that they were visible, to show that counsel was aware of them, and you know, have ultimately the motion court decide.
But the question, the burden's then on the state to show, as a safety consideration, he needs to be the defendant needs to be shackled. Your burden is not to say it's to find the negative. I mean, it would be the state's burden to show there's a danger and that's why they still need to be shackled?
Certainly at the trial court level, Judge, it is the state's burden. Okay. I think, you know, for me to get back to trial court, to get back to circuit court, I have to show that, you know, the burden comes back to me to show that it was indeed an unnecessary. And obviously we think we can make that proof at an evidentiary hearing on this matter. Unless the court has other questions on the other points that we raised, I'd ask the court to remand this case for an evidentiary hearing on all matters raised.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, I think the question on prejudice, we must keep in context, this is a post-conviction relief motion, and that the question isn't whether or not appellant was prejudiced by shackles. The question is whether or not appellant was prejudiced by his counsel's failure to object to the stat.
And I think that's what he said, is he needs to show, had it been timely raised, the court, because Deck clearly says as the routine use of shackles is improper. Of course, sometimes it's proper, but given their prejudicial effect, due process does not permit the use of visible shackles if the trial court has not taken into account the circumstances of the particular case. There has to be a hearing where the court looks.
And I agree that at the trial court level, you raise that claim, that's the only standard here. But he's got to he has to prove, because it's a post-conviction relief motion, that he's got to prove the prejudice in post-conviction relief from counsel's failure to make the objection.
But he can't prove that if he doesn't have a hearing.
Right. I mean, that burden is on him. We do think that in order to merit an evidentiary hearing, the record must show the prejudice, or you have to allege the prejudice.
But the whole point is there was no hearing at trial, so he couldn't have shown it at trial. That's his whole point, is counsel didn't raise it.
And Deck says there's a presumption of prejudice, so he doesn't have to prove prejudice, does he?
He doesn't have to prove prejudice trial level. He does have to prove prejudice in post-conviction level. I think this court's recent opinion in the Strong case makes it clear that something where we'll presume prejudice at the trial level doesn't overcome the fact that at the post-conviction relief level, you have to prove prejudice from counsel's ineffective assistance. So here, he's got to show that he was prejudiced because he was wearing visible shackles without...
But the most he would have to show, I mean, the prejudice would be the state's burden. It would have been the state's burden at trial to show that there are reasons why he needed to be shackled. And so the issue in post-conviction, I guess, would be whether the state could have met that burden or at trial, not defendant's burden to show he didn't need to be shackled. But if he shows the jury saw him, then the state would have to, you'd have to have evidence that the court, had they held the required hearing, would have said, oh, you got to shackle this guy. He's a danger to in the courtroom.
It feels like we're just kind of going around in circles here.
Okay.
But again, because it's post-conviction relief, he has to prove that counsel, he has to allege, and we're still at the allegation phase, he has to allege that counsel was ineffective for failing to make this objection. And he has to show that he has to prove that he was prejudiced in that the outcome of the trial would have had a different result, but for counsel's failure to object.
No, but that's where Deck says you presume this would have affected the jury.
If this was raised at the trial level, not on a PCR. PCR is an entirely different, shifts the burden. It is a civil action, it is a collateral matter, and the burden goes entirely to the appellant to prove that counsel was ineffective, that counsel was deficient, and that he was prejudiced by counsel's actions.
You say his pleadings aren't stated with specificity or deficient. He stated that he, quote, could be seen by the jury in the shackles or the leg restraints. What was so deficient about that? What could he have said that would have been satisfactory?
I don't recall the part of the pleading that says he was paraded in front of the jury so that they could see the shackles. The only portion of the pleading I recall is that he said he believed that the shackles were visible. If in fact, appellant was shackled in a manner that wasn't visible, he could say, "I was shackled, and the shackles were visible to the jury."
Well, but that's like trying to go into the juror's state of mind or eyes, and then that he didn't have an opportunity to question or poll the jurors on, you know, did you really see me or not?
I mean, that's all he could do at an evidentiary hearing is say, "I think they would have seen me because I was walking right in front of them." He can't. Your burden would be impossible without actually calling jurors, which I've never seen anything required.
I'm sorry. I'm not trying to say that he has to prove that the jurors saw them and were affected. He's got to prove that they were visible to jurors, that the jurors that they were visible for the jurors to see, that the jurors, because if the jurors could not see them.
So if we think that a question of fact is raised by his saying, I believe the jury saw my legs in shackles because I walked in with them shackled and sat with them shackled, why isn't that enough to get an evidentiary hearing?
If you believe that the equivocal statement that I believe the jury could see them, or I believe that they were visible shackles, not pled with certainty that the shackles were visible to the jury, but if you believe that you can satisfy the strict 2915 pleading requirements with that equivocal language,
a language that I walked in front of the jury with these shackles on?
And again, I say I don't recall that. If it's in the pleading, I'm sure Mr. Thompson will come up and read that portion. That may be sufficient to allege that part.
Are you saying you think it wasn't in there?
I don't recall it being in there. It's obvious that the only portion is the portion that I referred to in my brief where I believe he was equivocal as to the other jurors.
So if we had an evidentiary hearing and the defendant were asked, so do you think the jury could have seen your shackles and he saw your shackles and he said, I believe they did, you would say that was not sufficient?
I don't think it'd be clearly erroneous for the motion court to say that wasn't sufficient. He's got to prove that the violation actually occurred, not that he think the violation.
But then you're getting into the point of what's obvious, what isn't. It's sort of a metaphysical issue. Mm-hmm. Basically, if he has to say, I believe they saw it, because he's not seeing it from the juror's eyes. It's basically, if he said the juror saw it, then you're actually looking for actual evidence from the jurors they saw it.
At an evidentiary hearing, what they can establish is that the shackles were over my pants, that they were bright and shiny, that the jury saw me from the legs down, or saw all the way down.
Or that I walked with a gait that was not a normal gait because my ankles were shackled.
If all they can see is a normal gait, I think I look at the example that we cite in Nicholson, that the jury could have sensed that I was wearing the shackles because they could hear the shackles clanging and the paper around the table trying to shield it was enough. And this court said no.
Well, wouldn't that be a question of fact for the trial court or for the motion court?
It's only a question of fact to the extent that the motion court, that the post-conviction motion sufficiently alleges the facts. We don't say kind of allege the facts or allege them with uncertainty, and then we get an evidentiary hearing to clean that up later. And then it's not a notice pleading. It's a strict fact pleading. The motion court should be able to pick up the motion and say, if everything on here is proven just as it is, he wins.
If we were to find that saying, I believe the jury saw my shackles were sufficient, on that issue, is there another issue that you say precludes it from going for an evidentiary hearing?
Yes, and there are actually two. And this one's related to the other one. Again, he wants to go on the assumption that, well, since I said I was paraded in front of the jury, which to me does not say that with visible shackles, but if you say I was paraded in front of the jury, and if you can take from that and assume that plus I believe the shackles are visible equals I was wearing visible shackles, you still have... you don't allege that counsel was aware that he was wearing visible. Now you say, well, we can assume that because this court has repeatedly stated the purpose of 2915 motion is to allege every fact necessary.
And so isn't that why he wants an evidentiary hearing?
He wants an evidentiary hearing, but he has to allege every fact necessary to show that he's entitled to relief in his motion. This court has said that. It said that in Morrow. It said that in White. We've cited those
cases. Can you find any imaginable circumstance in which counsel sitting next to their defendant who's shackled would not know that they're shackled?
If
counsel being incompetent for not noticing?
I was wearing visible shackles. Say, I was wearing shackles. They were visible. They could be seen on the outside of my clothing. I was sitting next to counsel. This wasn't a hard thing to plead. All you had to bring up is counsel was aware I was wearing shackles. One line in a pleading satisfies the necessary fact pleading, but you have to prove that counsel knew or should have known of things. To allege that, that's all you have to say. We're not saying that.
Isn't the fact that counsel filed a motion in limine to preclude shackling inherently evidence that counsel was aware that he was going to be shackled for trial?
Is it inherently aware that he was aware and then thus
he would never have filed a motion to prevent it, which he was unsuccessful on, if he did not know that he was going to be shackled for trial?
It was a pre-trial motion. It wasn't actually done at the time of trial. It may have been the court's practice. And we're right. We don't have a record on the ruling. It wasn't as if that motion was denied. We never, the record doesn't reflect any rule. I think if the motion was denied, then we probably have counsel not being ineffective because he raised the claim and it was denied. So if it was, you know, it may have been one of several boilerplate motions that get filed. I remember back to the public defender, I'd file it whether I knew he was going to be shackled or not, just to have it on the record that it was said. I think what that shows is that counsel that the defendant wearing visible shackles was an issue that counsel was actually concerned about during trial. And if appellant was actually wearing visible shackles that could be seen in the jury, the counsel actually would have objected.
Then he gets to step three, which would be the jury sees the shackles, counsel knows they have shackles.
Right.
And then the you can see that the judge did not have a hearing on whether or not they were necessary.
Yes, absolutely. And if he had alleged those two things, at least then the only thing that we would have left to talk about is the prejudice prong. And I sense a disagreement already on who has to prove what in the prejudice prong, but we think the record shows that there wasn't the prejudice that appellant was saying. Essentially, what is the prejudice from being shackled in front of the jury? The primary one listed in DEC is that it overcomes the presumption of innocence and tends to show that the appellant is a dangerous person.
Remember, we agree with you in DEC. There's a higher court right. that said we were wrong.
Right, no, I understand. But would you...
And
but,
fool burn us once, we remember.
I understand. But understanding that in a post-conviction case, that if he gets to an evidentiary hearing, he's going to have to plead the prejudice. And if the record shows that there wasn't prejudice, that's a reason to deny.
And what you're saying is it's not simply prejudice that he might have had a meritorious claim
right.
under the post-conviction standard. The prejudice is that it would have resulted in a different
that
result.
Effect, yes, exactly. That the Strickland standard of prejudice, and this is a Strickland proceeding, is that because counsel failed to object, appellant, the outcome of the trial would have been different.
But since the Supreme Court in DEC said ipso facto, if you're seen shackled in front of the jury when you're not dangerous and there's not a need for it, it is reversible error. I understand your point right. about the prejudice, but wouldn't that be shown by showing the trial court, had there been a hearing, would have found that there was not a sufficient showing of danger in order to merit shackling him? Because the U.S. Supreme Court has told us in DEC that once they see you in shackles, it has an automatic prejudicial effect.
Again, that comes back to the issue that we saw in Strong with Batson. If the Batson claim would have been sustained, then the structure would have been, that's not, while reversible, we don't go into prejudice, while reversible on direct appeal.
But no, that's very different because the U.S. Supreme Court has not said that Batson is automatically reversible. In fact, I recall that was the argument of the state in that case, was that they had not done what they have done here and say that it affects the underlying.
Well, no, on a direct appeal, we don't go into Batson and say, well, were you really prejudiced by that? We don't do that on direct appeal in a patch case. Same thing, we don't do it on, we wouldn't do it on direct appeal in a shackling case. We can't go back, well, defendant's got to show that there was prejudice. But this is a PCR case, and this is he has to show prejudice not from the shackling, but from counsel's ineffective. And in the end, that still comes out to the verdict would have been different had counsel.
It's not whether he would have been entitled to a new trial. It is whether he suffered prejudice in the conviction.
Right, exactly. Whether his conviction is unfair, and that does shift the burden despite that. We don't think that actually governs in the post-conviction on who's got to show prejudice.
Is that why you didn't cite Deck at all in your brief?
I didn't cite DEC.
You didn't cite DEC once, which is the dispositive U.S. Supreme Court case. I was somewhat surprised by that.
I didn't cite DEC because I considered this to be a fact and prejudice case as opposed to being a shackling case. I mean, shackling's the context here. Ineffective assistance of counsel is the issues. And so we cite the cases that were relevant to pleading requirements and prejudice, not the cases that are necessarily relevant to the
even
issues.
Even though that case sets out the standard for if the jury saw it, then it's automatically prejudicial, and that's what you say he has to prove. In the evidentiary
that's
hearing.
Not what he has to prove. He also has to prove that he had an unfair, that his trial is unfair
right.
and that the outcome would have been different right. but for. That's not part, I'm sorry, that's just not yeah. part of the standard for Strickland prejudice.
And on the third point, you concede the trial court didn't even rule on it?
Yes. Yes, there is.
And you claim it's an isolated issue, so we shouldn't feel the need to remand on that.
As long as the issue can be resolved by looking at the record and we've set out our argument there. That the record clearly shows that the evidence was admissible, and therefore there isn't need for a useless remand. That isolated issue case, that line of cases come from the Court of Appeals. I'm not familiar with this court's ruling on that same thing. This court would have to determine whether whether the policy reasons of judicial economy and consistency with the rules of civil procedure, which seem to say if you don't object to the lack of findings at the trial level, it's an unpreserved claim on appeal, and you just go ahead and proceed on the merits of the issue. We believe that the record refutes his claim because that evidence was admissible. Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Thank you. I will take Mr. Sarn's invitation to direct you to the legal file, page 28 of the post-conviction legal file. We pled, you know, that movement's rights were violated in that movement was shackled with steel anklets while in the courtroom and was at one point paraded into court past assembling jurors while handcuffed as well. I think we've pled enough to get back to circuit court. We've pled enough to have these questions of fact fully heard before the motion court. I agree with the court that this is like a structural error. I mean, we can presume prejudice, but I'm saying not only do we have this sort of structural error, a man being shackled without any sort of proof that he needed to be shackled, but we've got prejudice to boot. So I think it did have an outcome on the proceedings, both at the trial, and I think it's fair to say that it would have been raised on appeal had there been any sort of record made about this topic. And I want to answer a little bit about the argument of the state that the pleading requirements require more of post-conviction movements. I think there's a danger that, obviously there's a danger with being too succinct, too conclusory, that that you haven't put the court on fair notice of what your claim is. But there's a likewise danger that was cited too in the Morrow case of being too obtuse, having too lengthy a pleading that the court really can't divine, you know, what evidence goes to what. I think, you know, if I were to plead, for instance, in this matter, and I was post-conviction counsel below, that the jurors actually saw the anklets, then I could be accused of having made a conclusory statements, and that thus my pleading didn't require an evidentiary hearing because it was conclusions and not facts that I was stating. I think we've pled enough to get back into motion court on this issue. I'd like to address briefly the topic of the appellate counsel ineffectiveness that the motion court did not deal with. I think the Breeden case cites a rule, I think that's out of the Southern District, that really is going to swallow the requirement of Rule 2915 that the court's required to make findings of facts and conclusions of law as to all issues presented. The Breeden case is factually distinguishable. It was a post-conviction movement who had made a successive claim, one that had been raised several times before. It might have been out of time even. That would have indeed been a useless remand. Not so here. I think there's legitimate questions of fact about whether the state could introduce what is seemingly great rebuttal evidence in their case in chief, and thus prejudice Brian Dickerson really from the outset of the trial. This other incident was the first bit of evidence that they got into in the state's case. If there are no further questions, I'll sit down. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The case